It's the Popmatic Podcast for February 25th, 2014. Size does not matter. Popmatic Podcast, where you can rock out with your library card out. In the booth today are
Jeremy,
Mike,
and I am Brian. Ironically, we are in the middle of Snowbama 2015, so there is a...
Don't blame me, I voted for a Snow McCain.
there is an abbreviated podcast crew today, even though this won't post until February 25th. We're recording on the 18th, and it is still an icy hell outside. Now, the reasons we're making these jokes about size is because February is the shortest month most of the time, and brevity is next to godliness or something like that. So this week, we get short, we get small. We tell you about the things that are small in stature but pack a big punch.
Boom.
Jeremy.
I'm going to talk about a fantasy collection by an author named Karin Tidbeck. Fantasy isn't just a realm we escape to. It's something we often run from with our eyes open and screaming and hysterical. It's best not to look back at whatever horrors are behind you, but Swedish author Karin Tidbeck does more than look back. She lingers. And what she sees is recorded in her really amazing collection, Jagannath. Her work has appeared mostly in her native Sweden, with some English publications in Weird Tales and other purveyors of literary oddities. And there's a timeless old world feeling in her stories, a feeling that these sorts of things sort of used to happen. There's magic in the woods and anthropomorphic plants, machine-beast hybrids, and some pretty intense body horror. It's the stuff of dreams and nightmares and tales told so many times we assume they've always been with us. Her story, Pirate, is everything that is great about this book. It's a catalog of wonders, a study of the unreal, a confirmation of strange goings-on. It's presented as an academic essay, and it catalogs the events surrounding a cryptid throughout history, including the narrator's personal account of this cryptid, the pirate, assuming the form of all the residents of a small village. Now, it begins as kind of a dry examination, like very much like an academic essay, complete with footnotes, and then it slowly becomes kind of light and funny, and then it sort of leaves you unguarded for when it just becomes super creepy by the end of the story. Her stories, Augusta Prima and Ants, both take place in the same world. This is kind of like another realm where time is thin and powerful beings entertain themselves with wicked games of croquet and never-ending orgies. The ants in the story, Ants, are three grotesque beings sitting on couches, and their only purpose is to grow larger and larger. I'm going to give you a quote here about Great Ant. She's the biggest woman. Tidbeck writes, "Her body flowed down from her head like waves of whipped cream, arms and legs mere nubs protruding from her magnificent mass." That's pretty creepy and makes my unsettled stomach more unsettled. When time finally does come to their realms, the ants are to be replaced, and there's a cannibalistic ceremony of death and rebirth, and it follows one of the most vivid scenes in a book that's filled with them. This strange realm feels like a place Tidbeck will visit again, a depository for her most out-there ideas, and if we're lucky, she'll take us there again sometime. Unexpected is the word which best describes all of these stories here. There's a couple which I didn't like as much as the others, and usually it was obvious within a paragraph or two which one I was going to like more or less. But Tidbeck leaves little room for doubt. When you start reading, something happens and she just doesn't let you go. The book is only 142 pages. It's a small book, but the wonder it evokes is immense. She is the winner of the Crawford Memorial Award in 2013, and this book was shortlisted for the Tiptree Award and the World Fantasy Award.
Racking them up.
Yep.
Yeah, good stuff.
Who's the Crawford Award named after?
I'm not sure.
Corrections! It was the total setup.
Thanks, yeah.
I did it on purpose.
I saw that. I started reading that, and I said, maybe I should have figured out what that award is. You guys don't know?
I know the Campbell Award.
It's
not
for
the Crawford Award.
Joan Crawford?
Ah.
Joan Crawford Award? She has really arched eyebrows.
The William L. Crawford Fantasy Award. is a literary award given to a writer whose first fantasy book was published during the preceding 18 months. Mm. It's one of several awards presented by the International Association of the Fantastic in the Arts.
Wow. You did your literature.
Yeah, I like the snob looking.
No, that's even better because I tell you it even has more snob factor because it is presented at the conference each March in Orlando, Florida.
Which
is a really classy place.
If I think of magical fantasy land, I think Disneyland.
You know what? I wish I was in Orlando, Florida right now. I would take Florida.
I like this ice hell. It feels fantastic.
Yeah, you're cold and unfeeling.
So a couple weeks ago, when you were looking up for civil rights stuff, I was trying to find like stuff in the pop culture of the time. Looking up, I tried finding science fiction-y stuff, and one of the things that was brought up was the works of Cordwainer Smith, a short story writer who was popular in the 50s and 60s. He died in 1966. I was a big fan of, as I mentioned before in this podcast, I was a big fan of like New Wave science fiction and, you know, pre-New Wave. I think he would have fit in there if he lived long enough. Cordwainer Smith was the pen name of Paul Myron Anthony Linebarger. In real life, Linebarger was a doctor of political science who pioneered the use of psychological warfare and whose godfather was Sun Yat-sen, the revolutionary who overthrew the Qing dynasty in China. Weird.
Take that, Isaac Asimov.
Well, that'd be, you know, a cool factor, you know. I mean, Isaac Asimov fled with his family from the Soviet Union. That's kind of neat.
He had cool sideburns.
That he did. I was one of the Isaac Asimov sideburns.
Best. He could have been a president.
L. Sprague de Camp goatee.
He could have been a werewolf president.
Like Rutherford B. Hayes.
He was very hirsute, if you see pictures of him.
Like all over, like Robin Williams level.
Like Duck Dynasty beers. If I was ZZ Top, I'd want my money back. I'd ask for a realty check.
A realty check? For like a house?
I apologize.
Correction!
I'm a professional journalist. I'm a professional broadcaster.
Little known fact, Isaac
royalty Asimov. Check.
A loyalty check?
A royalty check.
Oh. Isaac Asimov is the ghostwriter for Unfiltered by Phil Duck Dynasty.
He never died.
Robinson.
He's just a brain in a jar that's it.
Yeah.
Whoa, like, you know. A science fiction story.
Yeah.
Isaac Asimov dies of AIDS, which he did.
AIDS?
Yeah, he got a blood transfusion in the
80s. Oh, wow.
And that was before they tested for it.
I did not know that. I'm sorry, we totally derailed you.
It's okay. But I'm thinking, you know, brain in jar, and now he does ghostwriting stuff for celebrities.
Yeah.
It's like his own personal hell, you know.
This is a short story.
How could you, Isaac, you know.
I don't think he'd get along with the guys from Duck Dynasty.
Maybe not.
Well, he's been in prison in a jar. He can't really do it.
That's right. Yeah. He wouldn't get along with anybody.
He's enslaved.
Yeah.
That's right, yeah. It's but like, he sneaks in, you know, references to the Foundation and the Mules within the Duck Dynasty Unfiltered, you know.
If you listen to their duck quacks backwards.
And then during the second
you can hear ghost messages from the imprisoned brain of Isaac Asimov.
After the fall of the Galactic Empire, my psycho-historical precept set by Harry Sheldon. Seldon. We've gone off the nerd rails.
Yeah.
using the name Cordwainer Smith, he devised a future history of humanity, set 12,000 years in the future, where man has colonized space with an empire called the Instrumentality of Mankind. A recurring theme in his work is the struggle of a class of people called the Underpeople, who were uplifted, a genetically modified race of animals, or used as like a slave race. The Instrumentality itself is ruled by a decadent class of immortals. And in fact, there's a story that I totally want to read now, I looked it up this morning, about a guy who's so rich that he buys Earth. So he comes to, like, stake out Earth. A standout story for me that still haunts me to this day that I read over two decades ago is called A Planet Called Shyol, about a guy who's sentenced to live on a planet where there's a microorganism that causes all the inhabitants to grow extra limbs. It's supposed to be incredibly painful, and eventually he grows so many arms and legs and heads that you can't move. And so every so often somebody comes down and harvests your limbs to use for medical use. And then the process begins anew. It also gives you immortality, so you can't die, as like a thing of mercy that can actually destroy your brain so you don't have to feel this. But the main character guy is like, I can do it. Pish posh. Unfortunately, I pulled a Brian how he actually finished the book that I checked out, The Best of Cordwainer Smith, edited by John J. Pierce. But I did finish a pretty cool story called Scanners Live in Vain about a type of people called Habermans, who have been cybernetically modified to have no emotions. They are the explorers of the Instrumentality, sent out to discover new planets to colonize. But they're seen as creepy second-class citizens by the rest of the population because they're weird and have this, like, box implanted in their chest, you know. This is the 50s. They don't have really cool cyborg stuff. The main character, Martel, is recently through a process called cranching, which allows him to feel again for a brief time. It's pretty cool. And I thought I'd mention, there's the Corwin Smith Rediscovery Award, where they give awards to, people, science fiction writers who should have rediscovery, you know, by the kids these days. Mm-hmm. So, Henry Kuttner and C.L. Moore, others.
Pamela Sargent.
There's a really cool, and we're going to get into awesome corrections next time. I believe her name's Mildred Klinger. She wrote a book in the 50s. It sounded really awesome. Unfortunately, I can't tell you the plot of it right now. It sounded really cool.
So you had read Cordwainer Smith in the past,
yeah.
Though, right?
Yeah. No, I've read the stories of his, before.
Did Harlan Ellison write a story as Cordwainer Smith one time?
He wrote Smith stories as Cordwainer Bird. That was like his version of like Alan Smithy.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I thought was that a tip of the hat to Cordwainer Smith?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I thought there was because of general confusion in my brain, I thought there was confusion or mystery surrounding who Cordwainer Smith was.
I guess you have James Tiptree Jr.
Okay, that's a woman.
I was thinking of bringing that up for Women's History Month because I got a biography of her.
That's a woman.
She was really fascinating because, they did like one of those like linguistic analysis things like they did with J.K. Rowling because like she...
Oh, sure.
They tried to track her down because she was very reclusive because she didn't want to be discovered.
Right.
And when they finally, some fans were going to give her an award and they tracked her down, she basically just kind of cracked and never wrote again.
Wow.
And apparently, like, being a guy was, like, essential to her, like writing persona.
Well, lots of women, especially the short story writers for, like, the sci-fi magazine and stuff, they would use initials and stuff, right?
Yeah, C.L. Moore is Catherine Moore, and Lee Brackett was a woman.
Oh, yeah. Lee Brackett wrote Empire Strikes Back.
Lee Brackett was one of the Corwin Smith rediscoveries.
So speaking of awards, too, I didn't say this, but I could have said, who's the Tiptree Award named after?
James Tiptree.
Named after James Tiptree Jr., it was a pseudonym for Alice Sheldon.
Yeah.
Who was a woman. And now the James Tiptree Award goes to the sci-fi or science fiction book that deals with gender in a new or interesting way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We don't have any of her books in the system, but we have a lot of those award winners.
We used to have her books.
Oh, yeah. I didn't think we did.
No, we have her books.
I hope so.
Oh, yeah, we have them.
Okay.
We have some of them, and I don't know if we have her biography anymore. Yeah. There's just a couple years ago, a big biography of James Tiptree came out.
Yeah.
And she was like one of these people that are just like way too intelligent for their own good. Like a polymath, like genius. But anyway, on this episode of Science Fiction Awards, I'm just gonna go even further.
Sci-fi, pop-matic.
I'm just gonna go even further down this nerd wormhole, and I
this
swear,
could be the best episode ever.
We did not
in a row.
We did not plan this. I want you to listen.
We did all these.
We did not plan this, right? We did these individually, and there's no one here to balance us out because of Snowball.
We really needed Amanda to bring in some like romance or something.
She was gonna talk about Schubert or Satie for the short episode.
Oh,
that would have been nice. I could still throw some samples in there. I could throw some nice Satie interludes, right? It'll be nice. So this. Now it's even hilarious for me to even talk about this. I wanted to talk about Star Trek, the newspaper comics.
Oh, wow. That sounds pretty cool.
I own both volumes of those.
I have the cartoon for a while.
I still own the cartoon.
Yeah. I read 3 Star Trek comics yesterday.
Awesome. Yeah. So
trade paperbacks or comics?
Comics.
Oh.
Gold Key, too.
Gold Key. Wow. All right. Vintage.
Those are the real ones.
Yeah.
Right. So Star Trek, the newspaper comics, a daily strip, ran from 79 to 83, right? And, and the first volume, which the library has, which ironically is not small. It's this huge tome, right? Yeah. It's this huge book.
It's like a coffee table book.
But the individual daily strips are very small. Well, so the primary artists and writers in that one are Thomas Warkentin, Ron Harris, and Sharman DeVono. It was daily, one little strip, and then longer ones on Sundays in color. These were actually semi-lost for years because Paramount Pictures didn't keep records of what newspapers had them, so no one ever knew like how many people actually read them. And they mostly were in small newspapers and not big major newspapers because a lot of newspapers already had Star Wars and Buck Rogers, so like they didn't need another sci-fi strip. Yeah. So even like for a lot of years, a lot of Trekkies didn't even know that this comic had existed. Of course, it's reprinted by IDW, someone who reprints a lot of old stuff now and a lot of new stuff with other people's intellectual properties, and we'll get more to that later. But this is the original series Star Trek, so Spock, Kirk, Bones. I think your mileage will vary. You need to be a Trekker or a Trekkie. You need to be into comics or...
I have a nerd question.
Yeah.
So is it within the continuity of Star Trek the Motion Picture? So do they wear those outfits and he's got curly hair?
Oh, I'm going there. Just wait for it. I'm going there.
Okay.
The pervert from Seventh Heaven is there.
Oh, God.
Is he on the strip?
I don't know.
I'm on the edge of my strange-looking seat.
So that's a little bit of spoilage.
Oh,
but if you're not... So if you're not into hokey SF... You know what I mean? Or goofy pop culture. I think you could go there, but if you're into that, go there. I loved it. Now, if you are into Star Trek, this is very interesting. It's one of the few Star Trek iterations that use the Star Trek motion picture uniforms.
Ooh.
These horrible beige pajamas, right?
They're terrible.
Like, it's one really of the bad. Reasons that Gene Roddenberry lost creative control of the Star Trek movies is because he insisted on these terrible creative decisions.
I've never understood the fashion choices for the future that people make. Like, even what...
Yeah.
I'm deep into Voyager at this point, which I think I started talking about when I joined the podcast. And... Whenever they're in their casual stuff, it's always some hideous vest. They dress like a teacher would in an SNL sketch or something. It's just like they might as well have like a little applique apple on the vest. And then
I think just much like doing this podcast, I have to create something once a week and they just, okay, man, go. Don't stop.
But it's like,
just hit record.
I mean, jeans and a t-shirt like have not changed much in the last 55, 60 years. I mean, I realize that is a bit of a stretch to say, but there's not. But like, let's put that forward another 200 years. Like,
that's the thing I liked about Babylon 5, or one of the many things, I guess.
Well, they wore
the fashion
Levi's?
Was weird. Like, I mean, it wasn't the only thing that changed is that men didn't wear ties.
Oh, okay.
Other than that, we pretty much wore the same stuff as casual wear, non-uniform stuff.
There's always some vest or something. And...
Well, that was Centauri underwear, but we've got yet another nerd tangent. So, what about Star Trek?
Keep going.
Costume on Battlestar Galactica was great, but anyway.
That's true. It was
costume design on Battlestar Galactica was great, but anyway.
Cargo pants and a tank top. That's
was militaristic, but even the civilian people, like the women, were still wearing pantsuits, right? If they were in charge, anyway.
Regular clothes.
So horrible Star Trek: The Motion Picture uniforms, and actually that's why the newspaper comic was launched as like a tie-in.
Mm-hmm. That's what
you gave
the timeline. That's what I. That's
yeah. Thought. So halfway through the comic, and this starts in volume two. But the library doesn't have this volume. They actually switch uniforms to tie in with the next with Wrath of Khan, but it's not mentioned at all in the strip. But I'll get more on that too. Now these are not canon, and if any of you guys want to explain what that means to the listeners, I don't know what that is.
That doesn't fall into the official story arc.
Official continuity.
The continuity of the shows
and
the
this
films.
This is an idea that fascinates me, that someone has a copyright to a fictional continuity, and they also have copyright to other stories that do not fall into the official continuity. And I just love...
The cartoon was in official continuity, so that's where James Tiberius Kirk came from.
I find all that stuff so frustrating, too,
and
because it's...
It's hard to navigate.
It's not like the actual continuity doesn't contradict itself constantly, too.
Well, yeah. But
anyway.
Yeah, look at Doctor Who.
So, sometimes with non-canon things in intellectual properties, it can be more interesting because you can break some rules.
That's where all the stuff that we associate with Superman, like a lot of the sort of classic, the faster than a speeding bullet, more powerful than the lead, all came from the radio show and the television show.
And Kryptonite.
On. Yeah. Yeah, I think maybe even Perry White and Jimmy Olsen might have come from that. I'm not 100%.
Future correction.
Sure. Yeah. But a lot of that stuff.
I don't know if it debuted in the comic or the radio show, but I'm reading The Secret History of Wonder Woman right now.
Oh, yeah?
And they said the kryptonite idea was probably introduced by a woman that worked on Wonder Woman.
Oh, wow.
And the idea that, because, Wonder Woman had a weakness, if you put her in chains, if a man put her in chains, she would be powerless.
Yep.
I forgot about that.
So they felt that, and one of the, and Marston, the guy that was, created Wonder Woman, he was all about, you have to have these, you can't be just all masculine all the time. You have to have, some sort of, softer side or, some kind of, Achilles heel or whatever. So one of the writers on Wonder Woman, might have introduced the idea of kryptonite to not make Superman as fascist as he was, quote unquote. Okay. So it's not canon. And now I'm starting to go meta already. You guys know that I like to go meta.
Oh boy.
So what I really liked
warp speed.
I could totally get into these
warp factor nines.
I could totally get into these stories like in a hokey science fiction way. But what I really actually kind of liked about it was because they're all one volume, they were supposed to come out every day, and then once a week there was a longer one. You could read 10 weeks in one sitting, and that really did weird things with the way the narrative worked. And I think that happens nowadays when we binge watch shows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or even it even happens too, and I guess it's been happening for a long time in comic books, when you get like a trade paperback of a lot of issues.
Yeah.
And you can actually see the shape of the narrative that the writers had in mind. And I think it usually actually takes away from the narrative experience, because you can see like, okay, the story's lagging, and then a whole bunch of stuff happens. Where if you're like watching a show week to week or reading a comic every day, you'd just be getting little bits of information, and I think you'd actually experience the way the artists and writers intended. Now, where you see this kind of breaking down is the miniseries, which is finally getting popular on the United States television, right? Where it's like, okay, that we know there's only going to be 10 episodes, so we're going to write for 10 episodes, and the story is good for all 10 episodes.
Yeah.
Where if you have a show that's open-ended but you don't know when it's going to get canceled, or a comic book series mm-hmm. that just comes out every week and it's open-ended, the story gets kind of malformed.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It changes your perception of it and your expectations of it, too.
I just get cynical because, you know, comics and TV shows are basically meant to make money.
Yeah.
So, like, it's not for an art reason that they end. It's because less people are watching it or, you know, less people are buying it and stuff.
I read it.
So there's never really a satisfactory ending.
Yeah. The comic book writer Matt Fraction, who does Sex Criminals and Hawkeye and a bunch of stuff, I read some quote from him where he was talking about the trick of writing comics is that you're always stuck in act two. Like, you sort of perpetually have to be, especially with if you're writing an established character, like everybody knows who Spider-Man is, who the crew of the Enterprise is, most people anyway, Batman or whatever. And so, like, you don't need to do any of that getting to know you sort of stuff. It's like, it's all like, here's the conflict. That's this conflict. Is anybody, here's another conflict. And it's sort of like, you're always trying to just maintain that ratcheted up pace. And that's kind of doesn't really work for a lot of people. I think people are weaning themselves off of that sort of constant thing. And I think bigger, like, chunks, like, of a miniseries or whatever, people are learning to enjoy that more.
I was going to bring this up in the future tickler. But part of the reason why I got out of comics as a kid was because there is no act three. There's no resolution. There's no character growth, especially in comic books. You know, they just put the reset button.
Yeah.
And if a writer does badly, the next writer will fix it.
Yeah.
Or if there's, you know, a stupid storyline that nobody likes, let us fix it. So, like, you get these stupid, news, like, Thor's going to be a woman. And, you know, people get outraged. And it's like, why? In 6 months, it's going to reset. Right. Who cares?
Right. Well, they killed Superman.
I mean, they sniped Captain America in the head.
Oh, yeah.
And he came back.
They put you know, the Superman in that horrible blue and red suit that time,
You could argue that that's actually a good thing about comic books, that you can do that. The narratives are already reset, and I think that's actually starting to happen with comic book movies. Like, you see it with Spider-Man and with Superman.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're like these different interpretations of Spider-Man and Superman, the same story over and over, but reinterpreted with different creative types.
There's a lot of talk even of, because Spider-Man is going to be in the Marvel movies now.
Yeah, I'm so excited.
But there's even talk of him not being Peter Parker and being
Miles Morales
who is half Puerto Rican, half African-American kid in the Ultimate Spider-Man comics. And, I mean, that's
cool,
like, kind of a big deal. I mean,
cool. Screw the grognards. Okay. Now, that's
Star Trek.
That's a board
Star
gaming.
Star Trek does change.
That's a board gaming thing.
Because the people on the shows die and get old.
Data's not Data anymore because he found he got too old.
He's B4. What Mike said about they make this stuff just to make money. I want to go back to that because that was a really good segue. And I think the king of this is IDW, the publisher of the reprint of the Star Trek, the newspaper comics. So they're the fourth biggest publisher of comics in the world. And they do a lot of comics, a lot of trade paperbacks, and they even do games now. Okay. Now, interesting, they don't have any original intellectual products as far as I know.
They just
buy other companies or other people's established intellectual properties and then put out projects based on them. For instance, Ghostbusters, Star Trek, G.I. Joe, Doctor Who, X-Files, to name a few. Yeah.
My Little Pony, right?
There was a G.I. Joe versus Transformers once, which was interesting.
I was going to say, that's definitely IDW. That's the kind of thing that they would do.
It is awesome.
So, and for me, the fact that this company exists and it's so successful, it just kind of drives home the ugly reality that so much of pop culture is just entertainment executives figuring out ways to make themselves a little bit more money by hawking cultural junk food to nerds, okay? And the case in point is the uniform change in the Star Trek The Newspaper comics. Mm-hmm. So, like, halfway through the comics run, they change the uniforms because there's a new movie comes out and they don't even mention it. It's like, oh, whatever. They'll just eat whatever we feed them. It doesn't matter. They'll just eat whatever we feed them, right? And IDW, they're in some ways, they're brilliant. In other ways, they're insidious. So They've started this line called the Library of American Comics, mm-hmm. and it's clearly this ripoff of the Library of America, which I believe is a nonprofit organization that reprints and that an editorial board decides what's important, and they put out these nice, affordable reprints on decent paper with, you know, cloth bound and a bookmark. And this is exactly the format that the newspaper comics are in, but bigger because they're graphics, right? So, like, not only are they just, like, buying these IPs, like, eating up IPs like a monster and then just producing all this junk, they're also, like, trying to get some sort of, like, intellectual cachet or whatever, or, like, provenance by taking these old comics and reprinting them just for money, you know?
Yeah.
Okay, now, I'm being a jerk, right? I'm a snobby jerk. I want you to know that the days I had off during Snowbomb, I spent designing a custom playmat for Star Trek the deck building game, an out of print game that nobody cares about anymore. And Brandon Braga's Star Trek the Next Generation Hive, which IDW put out, was an amazing comic book. I loved it. It should have been the last Star Trek movie. So listen, I paid my nerd cred, right? Okay. I can say whatever I want about these people. But
I think they also did Reanimator versus Army of Darkness.
Oh, yeah. Maybe.
Could be the coolest thing ever made.
As I said, they're insidious, but also brilliant. Yeah. And this goes into this whole idea of, like, there being a canon, because I don't think anything that IDW puts out is canon.
I don't think so.
I'd be surprised.
Yeah. And, you know, other companies buy the Star Trek license. They buy the Star Wars license. And they lose it. And I think what it is the license costs X amount of dollars. Whoever owns the IP to begin with, who is granting the license, gets, you know, so many points or whatever. It costs X amount of dollars up front. And then I would imagine, like, so much in royalties and everything you sell. I'd imagine that's how it would work. And I think some companies' products, they don't sell as much as they wanted, so they let the license go. Where here, I love that IDW is like a whole company based around that model. Like, we're only going to do stuff that we know works.
Yeah.
And it's not a knock to any of the artists that work or create things for IDW. They've done some really cool comics that I enjoy. And the Star Trek newspaper comics were thought to be lost. And even though it's an absolute cash cow, and they've put it under a disingenuous name to make you think it's part of a cultural nonprofit organization.
Wow.
You know, these exist now, and everyone can read them, and before they were gone.
So there's I need to spray on some vaccine because I've got some sick burns.
The licensed comic stuff has always, like, from the time that I started reading comics, and even before, actually, like, when I would go to the grocery with my mother on a Saturday morning, and I would look at, like, the baseball card magazines. I very specifically remember looking and seeing, I think it was Now Comics did a Married with Children comic book.
Yes.
And I was like, there's a comic Married with Children comic book? And they did Green Hornet, and I think they did Terminator for a while before Dark Horse did. And Dark Horse...
Yeah, that's how Dark Horse became a company.
Yeah.
They had licenses to
stuff. They had Star Wars and had Star Wars for 20-plus years and only recently lost it. And, like, I think all of their stuff is going out of print, and now Marvel has it, and Marvel has started Star Wars number one from whatever, and I think they're taking it back. And Star Wars had this enormous, massive volume of comics, like so many different titles and miniseries, and expanded the universe of Star Wars and all this stuff. And so much that they call it the EU, the expanded universe or extended universe. But and then there's all this argument about what's canon with that and not, because Disney is saying, this is canon, this isn't.
I want to be on a podcast where we do a whole episode on Disney's redrawing of the canon of Star Wars, because I love that this is just a really fascinating idea that they own the intellectual property rights over a fictional world.
Yeah.
And now, like, another contract has been signed Disney owns the Star Wars intellectual property. Oh. We decide now what's true, and I said this oxymoron in the last podcast. I was going to bring it up. They decide now what's true in this fictional world, yeah. And what's purely fictional in the fictional world. That's like as an intellectual exercise or a game or something to think about. Like, I love it, and I love too how like there's these degrees of fiction within the fictional world. Mm-hmm. So like the most farthest fictional would be like really bad fanfic, mm-hmm. like either like Slash horror, fic. Like you know sexual fanfic, horror fanfic, yeah. bizarro world fanfic. But then it sort of bleeds into this non-canon stuff. Where I think like IDW comes really close. They do all these weird mashups like G.I. Joe versus Transformers and Doctor Who versus X-Files. I mean, they put out those comics, right?
Uh-huh. This is Doctor Who, Star Trek, The Next Generation.
Yeah. So I that's just like a fascinating thing for me. And then also like a company like Disney who for years was like, we're going to sue you. And then Frozen came out and they did a shift. I don't know if you did like... They let people, like when people did songs and fan stuff about Frozen on YouTube, Disney did a total shift. It was like, hey, we're not going to attack you.
Oh, wow.
So I'm sure that they probably have some bots that do some automatic takedowns. But that's a huge shift for Disney. So.
Yeah.
Well, and the people that do that stuff, they're not, I mean, they are, it's a genuine sort of like.
They love it so much.
They love it so much. And it and all it does is just sort of further cement their. Wallets to that product, so like the companies have everything to gain from it. Really,
this is interesting. So the custom play mats that I built for the Star Trek deck building game, I'm gonna upload the files to Board Game Geek to see if other people want to like print them out and play on them.
Absolutely,
it'll be interesting if the people at Board Game Geek are like, no, that's not, you don't own the copyright to those Star Trek images.
Yeah,
we're not gonna let you put that up. So I'm interested to see. Like, I mean, as a librarian, these kind of issues fascinate me. So it's just, I want to, like, test the copyright waters.
That's good.
That's good.
Give us your full report.
That's great.
I wrote Teenage
You're popular at parties, aren't you?
I wrote Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle fan fiction when I was in fourth and fifth grade, but none of it survives.
I wrote a comic strip involving General Grant and Robert E. Lee hanging out. It was called The Silver War.
Wow.
I was a strange kid.
Yeah, totally.
Okay, we have 1 minute to do Tickle My Fancy.
My watch says five.
Okay, well, we have to go downstairs and make sure. If no one came to work, we have to go work. Oh, wow. But we don't know. No one had come in yet when we came up here.
Oh, crap.
So this is what is tickling my fancy this week. That it was just the three of us, and we had the nerdiest, most sci-fi episode of the Potmatic podcast ever.
I like we talked about so science fiction drove. And fantasy because I think those genres lend themselves to the short form, I think.
And then you grow up and don't care about them anymore. Oh. Unless you're, what's the word I'm talking, what's the word, like, what's the word?
Development?
Someone.
A loser nerd living in their basement?
No, there was this word that someone used to talk about horror fans recently in the New Republic. Oh, unless you're a regressive person.
I've also heard rejuvenile.
Yeah, I am both of those things because, like, I have plunged deeper into, like, buying comics and stuff. Like, when I became a parent, like, I had, like, a shoebox full of comics, and now I have a long box and another box and another box filled with comics that I haven't read yet because I'm a daddy.
I was going to talk about Raymond Carver's What We Talk About When We Talk About Love, which was the book that Birdman's play was based on. But
really?
Like, you know, that just too literary snob for
I just want to say – I'm unabashed in my love of the stuff that I love. But I do agree mostly with Thomas Dish's assertions in his really seminal essay on SF. He says that science fiction is for adolescents and it's for working class people primarily. Even if that isn't true, it's like an interesting critical springboard to test works against. I mean, like most meta-narratives, they fall apart under scrutiny, but it's... It works as a good, like, starting point. Corrections! Amanda was right last week. She did not name Funny Girl, which is the name of the new Nick Hornby novel. You should check it out. I casually mentioned that the Trans-Pacific Partnership might extend copyright terms 20 years. I didn't say how or in what context, but one of the terms in the Trans-Pacific partnership, this big treaty that's currently being negotiated, would be that member countries would have to extend their copyright terms to the same as United States terms, which is death of the author plus 70 years. Mm-hmm. So a number of countries, including Canada, New Zealand, Brunei, Malaysia, Vietnam, and Japan, would have to extend their terms to 20 years to make it equal America's terms. Just wanted to clarify that.
Okay.
Totally a nitpicky Brian thing. Mike was talking about the horror of Huckleberry Finn. I mentioned T.S. Eliot, and what I meant was not that T.S. Eliot is the horrible thing about literature for me, but T.S. Eliot's criticism of Mark Twain and his writings about Huckleberry Finn are the horror of literature for me.
Wow. I'll have to look this up.
That's a tease out.
Yeah, that's a ooh.
I wasn't expecting.
And of course, maybe my memory is failing me. Maybe he never said anything about Huck Finn. But I love T.S. Eliot. Every Easter, I read the Four Quartets. It's like this ritual that I do. And though I have issues with T.S. Eliot's ideology, I mean, The Wasteland is a work that cannot be ignored.
I had a class in college called American Masterpieces, and we read Moby Dick and Huck Finn and a bunch of all the Americans, I think. I think the only one I actually read was Huck Finn. But
I'm sorry.
I enjoyed it for the most part.
Oh, God.
But
I liked you.
Sorry, bro. But my professor, I think we maybe had to read a T.S. Eliot criticism or something. Or maybe we had to read something by T.S. Eliot. I can't remember exactly. But the professor sort of sat up at her table eating peppermints and said, T.S. Eliot was the most prolific writer in the 20th century or something like that.
What about Isaac Asimov?
A nerd sat up and said, I actually believe Isaac Asimov was the most prolific writer. And she's like, of the American literary canon.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh.
And she said that like whose work, like she kind of talked smack about genre stuff, you know.
Oh, of course,
but,
you know.
But he's not... like, but he wrote across all sorts of genres. He wrote science and humor and
she said, "Limp back to your yurt."
Yeah.
That's like, amazing, though, that you both said it. That's great.
So
I don't know if she meant.
Goodbye, child.
She meant volume, but she also meant, I think, impact. But I'm not here to argue one way or the other. It just made me think of that. But I do like that you both. Both fell on the side. I don't have a dog in that
I've read
fight.
His biography. He wrote so much that even he couldn't keep track.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean,
that's pathology. That's not literature. I know some other 20th century authors that are like that too. Okay. But for T.S. Eliot, for information about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, for the new Nick Hornby, for more information about this podcast, you can go to
www.library.nashville.org.
And our theme music is by
Adam Dean.
Next week, ironically, we celebrate Severe Weather Week.
Yeah.
We're going to rain on your parade.
Yeah.
In case you forgot, we're recording right in the middle of Snowbama 2015.
Snowbama.
Dwight D. Eisenhower.
Is that what Megan said?
Oh, boy. I watched a Weird Al DVD last night called The Complete Al, and it was like a fake documentary about his life, and then had his videos interspersed in, and then there were chunks from his Al TV program on MTV where he hosted videos, and he did amazing news bits where he sat next to a cardboard box and they just slid a picture into the box like you would have like a picture next to you on the TV screen, and he did this joke, and there was a picture of Elvis Costello, and it said, Elvis Costello announced his new tour this year, and rumor has it he's going to be on tour with ABBA. So ABBA and Costello are going to go on tour, but they haven't decided who's on first.
Al TV, another one of those music video kind of shows you watch on television sometimes.
Boy, I could just watch those videos all day long until my brain turns into mush, couldn't you? Well, I'm eating my lunch right now, so let's just keep the show going. You're watching Al TV, the music video program that helps build strong bodies 12 ways.